Hi everyone, this is Diva from Blood Hunter and you're listening to the Metal Pit Podcast.
Welcome to the Metal Pit Podcast. This is where we dive into albums and bands that made metal what it is today. I'm your host, Blake, and together we'll explore the sounds and the legends of metal. Don't forget to visit our website, which is themetalpit.org, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Metal Pit. And for the podcast, we have a website for the podcast, which is themetalpitpodcast.com, and it is also on Facebook and Instagram, and that's at The Metal Pit Podcast. And you can find us on YouTube at The Metal Pit 666. And if you have any questions, suggestions, comments, whatever, you can email me podcast@themetalpit.org. And I was just before I mentioned my guest, YouTube. I just added two new interviews that one of our writers, Lance Hall, did. And I didn't write down the names of the bands, but anyway, check out our YouTube channel. There's two new interviews on there that I just posted today. And my guest has been, this is his third podcast in a row with my guest here, James. How you doing?
Hey, Blake, I'm doing tremendous, my friend. There's never a bad time to talk heavy metal. So I'm excited about this episode, ready to dive in.
Okay, we're going to talk about a group that has 24 studio albums, which is kind of unheard of. And their last one was in 2024. And I believe I just saw a post from Girl School that I guess they just did a tour together. So they're still touring. And I don't know if they're making another album. I didn't look that far into knowledge to find that out. But anyway, we're going to talk about Saxon. And I'll just say now, Saxon, like, it depends how old people are that listen to our podcast. If we have people my age, of course, you're going to know Saxon. And you're younger, but you obviously know Saxon. But if there's any like 20 somethings, they might not even know who Saxon is. But of course, they were one of the bands in the new wave of British heavy metal back in the late 70s and early 80s, along with like Iron Maiden and Def Leppard and Judas Priest. But Judas Priest is kind of before that. They were formed in Barnsley, South Yorkshire, England in 1977. They were first known, I'm not sure it's first, but they were once called Son of a Bitch. But I think for good reason they changed the name. I don't think a band called Son of a Bitch would probably have 24 albums. Probably not. And let's see, the core of the band consists of vocalist Bill Byford, who is still in the band today, and is, I guess he's been on every album then, right? I guess, yes. So he's like, and also guitarist Paul Quinn, who was Paul Quinn on, I don't know if he's on the first album, but I guess he's still in the band today. So those two have been in it a long time. They've had a lot of other lineup changes, of course, over 24 albums and whatever, 50 years, I don't know, 1977, it's almost 50 years, I guess, of being a band. Their early albums, such as Wheels of Steel, Strong Arm the Law, Denim and Leather, and Crusader, kind of got their career going there. But we're going to talk about the fifth album, Power and the Glory. Fifth album. So do you remember when you first heard, now you're younger again, so you probably discovered them later and went back. But when do you remember first hearing Saxon or anything?
Yeah, sure do. So I was actually in college at the time. So it was my sophomore year. So we're going back to 2009. And that is when I very first heard Saxon. And it was actually one of the songs, it was more of an epic song off of their 2007 release called The Inner Sanctum. It's a song called Red Star Falling. And it's about communism. If I understand that correctly, that's the reference to the Red Star. And so I heard that album or that song rather first, and that one's up over 6 minutes long. It had a little bit of an epic feel to it, and I went backwards a little bit, checked out a couple of albums that came out before it, but then I kind of fell away from Saxon for several years, and it wasn't because I disliked it. It was just my tastes were a little bit different 16 years ago, and so I was into a lot of metalcore and some death metal and stuff like that. And I still enjoy that stuff, but I really hopped on the traditional heavy metal train a little bit later. So it was really right about 2022 or so, just a few years ago, that I dove back into Saxon. And this time it was the whole catalog. And so in 2022 was actually the year that they released Carpe Diem, which was their 23rd album overall. And so I had, needless to say, a plethora of material to dive back into. As you said, Blake, 24 albums as we sit here today and possibly still counting. I'm not sure. Hopefully they'll at least give us one more so they can end on 25. But I had plenty of stuff to go back through, and now I own all 24 albums that they currently have, and really enjoy all of them. So I sort of had a split story with Saxon. Got started in college and then fell away, and now I'm back in full force, and they are one of my absolute favorite bands now, I'm proud to say.
No, for me, I can't really, I can't really remember because again, there was so because back in 1982 is when I first started listening to heavy metal, as I've mentioned before, and so this album is 1983, so I don't really think I was listening to Saxon before I discovered heavy metal because I wouldn't they wouldn't be on the radio or anything like that, so but. So I can't even really tell you if it was Power and the Glory that I first heard, or if it was Denim and Leather. I might have heard that song somewhere before. And I'm surprised, actually, as I look at it, Strong Arm of the Law was from 1980, because I do remember that album quite well. But I'm pretty sure I didn't hear that first. But, you know, I can't really remember. There's only a few, like I've said before, like I can remember when I first heard Iron Maiden and I first heard Metallica and Slayer and some of those groups. But some of these groups, it's impossible to pinpoint when I did first hear them. But anyway, so yeah, so we're going to talk about that album. But first, let me, I got a few notes here on Saxon, which you probably know, but some people might not know. Let's see. As I said, they played a crucial role in the new wave of British heavy metal with Iron Maiden and Def Leppard. Supposedly they turned down, where is that? Where's my, oh, sorry, I'm on the wrong part of my screen here. First of all, yeah, they turned down a record contract offer for, it doesn't say from who, but they wanted them to be more like Def Leppard or hair metal or whatever. And it was a huge record deal. It says it was in the late 80s there to make a more commercial glam metal style, but they refused to do that and chose to stay to their heavier sound. I guess we would call them power metal, or maybe they were one of the first power metal bands, maybe, I guess we would say. I mean, they're a new wave of British heavy metal, but you know, some of the, especially this album, maybe that we're going to talk about, or at least the title track is kind of maybe one of the first power metal songs, but. Let's see, and I mentioned they were called Son of a Bitch once. They were a major influence on lots of bands, most notably, I think people, Lars Ulrich is always, of Metallica, is always saying that Saxon, he gave Saxon, Lars Ulrich was on the Conan O'Brien podcast once. I think this was probably over a year, maybe 2 years ago, but he mentioned Saxon, who I'm sure. Not, I'm sure Conan, even though Conan likes some heavy music too, I think, from listening to his podcast, but he probably didn't know who Saxon was, so he was giving a shout out to Saxon there. And I guess they used to cover Motorcycle Man on their early live shows, but I don't think they put a Saxon song on their covers album that they did. But anyway, they were one of the first bands to tour, one of the first new wave of British heavy metal bands to tour the US, like with Iron Maiden and Def Leppard and Judas Priest. And let's see, of course, as I mentioned, Bill Byford is one of the longest serving frontmen. It's in metal, but I suppose in anything, like I guess Mick Jagger still runs Rolling Stones if they make any music. I don't know if they really make any music anymore. But even like Ian Gillan left Deep Purple and then came back. But and Ozzy, of course, left Sabbath and I guess is kind of back for whatever farewell. Again, tour thing or show. But anyway, okay, Saxon, they also have their own beer. Wheels of Steel beer, I guess it's called. And that, of course, is from one of their album titles. And I guess Byford also released a spoken word album called School of Hard Knocks. Did you hear that? No? I don't know.
Wow, that's interesting. I had not heard that. I would love to hear it, though. I might have to go look that up now.
Yeah, it's just, I guess it's under just under his name, I'm assuming. It just not j there's music too, but there's also spoken word storytelling about his life in rock and roll. Anyway, so we're going to talk about Power and the Glory. So like I said, fifth studio album. And this was a little, I guess this was supposedly more polished of a sound and more Americanized or whatever it says from they had producer. Now I gotta find that. Paul, oh wait, the core, that's the guitar. Sorry, I'm all over the place here. I got too much stuff because they've been around too long. Produced by Jeff Glucksman. And it marked a move to more Americanized sound, I guess. And this is also the first album to feature drummer Nigel Glockler. And he brought a new level of precision to the band's rhythm section. And I can mention the rest of the band, as I mentioned, Paul Gwynn on guitars, Graham Oliver on guitars, and Steve Dawson on bass guitar. So, Power and the Glory, title track. What do you think of the title track?
Yeah, so what a way to kick off the album, right? I mean, this is a nearly 6 minute track, so I don't know if you would want to call it an epic or not, because it doesn't exactly have some bombastic orchestral introduction or anything like that. It just has a hard charging heavy metal riff right from the jump, right out of the gate. Biff Byford comes in with those unmistakably identifiable vocals. I mean, when you hear Biff singing, you immediately know it's him. He's not someone who blends in with a crowd. And there's just a very cool melody here on this song. It's very up tempo in terms of the pace. The bass just comes in, the bass lines are pounding. And as you and I were talking about before recording started, I listened to the standard album in terms of the tracks, but it was the remastered version that was released in 2009. From what I was reading, at the time the album came out in 83, which was before my time, but I read that the production caught a little bit of flack from people at the time, as far as it not sounding maybe as good as those previous few albums, Wheels of Steel, Strong Arm of the Law, Denim and Leather. So I don't know if that's true or not, because I couldn't hear it when it originally came out, but the 2009 remastered version does sound really, really good. That rhythm section with Dawson on bass and Glockler on drums really does a nice job holding it down. And just think, when Biff Byford sings that part of the lyrics, when he says, "Raise your glasses high," I mean, how can you not enjoy singing along, right? We talked about on the Twisted Sister episode about how sometimes some of these bands have some lyrics or some sounds that are a little cheesy, but I continue saying, who doesn't love a little bit of cheddar with their heavy metal? I certainly do. But another, just a fantastic guitar solo on this is something I'll probably harp on just about every track on here. But there's also just a good, healthy dose of straightforward rock and roll on this album, even though, or on the song rather, even though it's an incredibly heavy track. So a great way to kick off the album, in my opinion.
Now, I was on Wikipedia, so this album peaked at number 15 in the UK, and it only peaked at 155 in the United States. But of course, it's probably one of the first. They were probably just getting their name over in the United States. But you mentioned the production or whatever. Now, of course, I didn't listen to the 2009. I get unless I put that one on my Spotify. I don't really remember. Like I have the album on Spotify, but I don't know if I ever really listened to the difference or anything. But there's two, they have two on Wikipedia, their Wikipedia page on this album. Some person said that it was sounded like it was recorded in a tin can, albeit a very, very large tin can. And it said it eliminated the big in your face and gritty sound heard on the band's past albums. But then you have another writer who says, who's Martin Popoff, actually from Canada, who I think I mentioned on the last podcast. But he says this is one of their best albums and he praised the production and of the album. So I guess it's I don't know. So I guess so I guess we can say what we want because two people don't agree and they're both, I guess, well-known writers. So who knows? But anyway, yeah, I remember I was gonna say Now, for me, Saxon, I listen to this album a lot. I listen to Denim and Leather a lot. I listen to Crusader a lot, but kind of after this one, where's my discography again? Oh, Crusader wasn't actually. Sorry, I listened to Crusader, and I do remember buying Innocence Is No Excuse, but I think after that, I didn't listen to them. I probably would listen to an album once or twice, but I just never got into it as much. But there was so many bands out there that I was probably into more, which we're going to do our top 10 out of 1983, and we'll kind of see how many great albums there was and how many of my favorite albums and bands throughout that year. So that's kind of why I probably kept going with some of those bands, but maybe with Saxon, I just didn't keep going. But it's awesome that they've been around for so long. But yes, Power and the Glory is one of the ones that I listen to the most. And yes, it was a great opening track, and I don't really have anything to add about that track. Now, it has been a while. I listened to this today, but it's been a while since I listened to this whole album. But the next track is Redline. And what do you think of this one?
Yeah, that's and just to touch on what you said just a second ago, really quickly, I think you said it peaked at number 155 on the US chart. From what I was reading, and it's funny, I read that same Wikipedia page that you referenced just last night to read about the tin can comparison when it comes to the production on it. That was pretty funny. But that same article did say that this is actually Saxon's first album to enter the Billboard 200 in the US. So that's interesting. That it, even though it's their fifth album, it was the first one to enter the US charts. So I guess, like you said, sometimes it takes a little bit of time for stuff to catch on, especially in the pre-internet days when if you know when you're talking about other countries, it's material that they weren't able to just access with the click of a button at that time. So it's interesting to see how all those things develop. And the only thing I can really say is I'm not 100% sure what they're doing with the album art. The album cover is interesting to say the least, but just wanted to toss that in real quick. Yeah, so Redline, track number two, a little bit shorter, just a little over 3.5 minutes. And this one starts off with a really strong, almost bluesy guitar intro. That's the impression I got when I listened to it anyway. And this song just has fun written all over it right from the jump. It's got a little bit of boogie to it, I like to say. It's one of those songs that really pace-wise, just the cadence of the song, it really makes you just want to kind of get up and move. You know, other people with who are fans of popular music, maybe they want to hit the dance floor. I wouldn't use that terminology for heavy metal, but makes you want to maybe get up and do some head banging and do some air guitar. My air guitar leaves a lot to be desired, but hey, if it's just me enjoying my music on my own, then that's okay. Yeah, the rhythm section once again really tight here with Dawson and Glockler just holding down the rhythm. Biff's vocals just soar as they always do. They still do to this day, by the way. I know we've referenced their longevity a couple of times, their staying power. When you think about as we sit here today, their debut was 79 and their most recent album was 2024. That is a 45-year span that they've been releasing new studio albums. So, and Biff Byford, I can confirm, seeing as how Hellfire and Damnation, the most recent album, is one of the best albums they have ever done, in my opinion. It's in my top five or six Saxon albums ever. That's how good they still are. But Biff's vocals sound just as vibrant and as vital as they did on some of these classic albums, which is really incredible. And then after the second time the chorus is sung, we get another incredible guitar solo. And this duo of Oliver and Quinn just tears it up on the entire album. It really is a pleasure to hear. They're making the instruments sing, is how I like to think about it. So just another very solid track that I could almost picture being played at a party, provided it was a heavy metal themed party.
And I guess the song is about driving fast and living recklessly. So yeah, that fits right in for metal people back, maybe not now, but back then. But yes. Oh no, I was going to add something there about this album actually reached number one in Sweden, Norway, France, and Germany. So it's But I guess, back, like you said, about there's no internet. And so back in the because it took a while for Iron Maiden to really make it big in the United States, and well, all of them, because you know you're playing in England and nobody's listening, you're not getting on the radio most of the time anyway, these kinds of groups. So yeah, it does take a while before you get noticed, I guess, in North America. And now it's like almost impossible. Well, I mean, it's not you get no it's easier to get noticed, but you're not getting as successful because now you can't afford the tour unless you sell a lot of albums, I mean. Anyway, so yeah, it's good track two. Then we go on to Warrior. And what do you think of this one?
Yeah, so the title of this track, Warrior, and I know, Blake, you made a reference to power metal earlier, and I do really do think that this album introduces some power metal elements that were not present on the first few. And so you just think of the word warrior, right? That's one of the characteristic lyrical themes of the power metal genre. It's swords and dragons and kings and warriors and that sort of thing. So this does sort of continue that theme. And we've got just a razor sharp guitar riff that kicks this one off. Just a few seconds in, you get Steve Dawson just coming thundering in on his bass, and we know we're off and running as listeners. We get some double bass drumming from Nigel Glockler on this song. And I don't know that double bass drumming was a particularly common thing in heavy music up until this point, although we are in 83 now, so as we'll likely talk about when we do our top 10 albums of 83, the birth of thrash was seen this year, and so double bass drumming was certainly a regular part of that. And prior to that, you had it sprinkled in here and there. I think we heard it a little bit on Judas Priest's song Exciter. Motorhead did it a little bit on the title track for Ace of Spades, and so there was some fast drumming here and there, but I don't think it was necessarily something that characterized heavy music frequently up until this point. But Glockler really lets it loose on the drums, and Biff sounds a little bit more ferocious on this song. Now he always has his melodic sort of operatic kind of soaring quality to his vocals, but he does get a little bit grittier. There's a little bit of gravel in that voice, almost like maybe he took a glass of eggshells and gargled it a little bit before he went to record this one. So I think his voice is really good here. And it does remind me, like I mentioned a second ago, a little bit of thrash and what we would see develop not only in this particular year, but over the course of the years that followed as that particular style started to really rise to the top, just with the speed and the shredding of the guitar work combined. And as the solo concludes here, I don't know if you got this impression, Blake, but it almost has a bit of a neoclassical type of feel to the song, which I thought that this would probably make Yngwie Malmsteen somewhat proud if he were someone who would admit something like that. I love Yngwie. I love his talent. I love his guitar playing. I have heard some of the comments about him being a little bit arrogant and difficult to work with. And I don't know if that's true, of course. I don't know the man personally, but I do think he would be proud of the guitar work here, just based on some of the shredding. And once again, these great lyrics resonate when Biff sings, "Warrior came, warrior saw, warrior conquered." I mean, how can you not have a blast listening to that? So another great track.
Yeah, a lot of the tracks, especially early on, maybe because I can't really comment on the last whatever 20 albums, 50, or whatever 18 albums, because I didn't spend that much time listening to them. But yeah, they have a lot of sing-along songs for the crowd, especially "Power and the Glory," like is in their top 10 songs they've played live ever. That song, and I'm sure this one too is high up there. Wait, oops, sorry, wrong. I got my set list thing here. Oh, what, this is Red Line? No, what, sorry, what song are we on? Four. No, they didn't play
Warrior.
this one. They only played this one like four times, I guess. Actually, live. And what then, but yeah, Red Line was 64 times. But anyway, but yes, it's and what, there was something else I wanted to say about this song. Warrior. Oh yeah, I guess it has a little bit of Iron Maiden ish feel in it too, with the twin guitar harmonies, but you know they're like Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Saxon. They're gonna have some similarities because they're all from the same area and same kind of style of music. But anyway, yes, and yeah, they do have a lot of lyrics like you said about war or Denim and leather is, I guess, a war about saying heavy metal, but then even Power and the Glory, of course, is about war. You got your like Manowar like lyrics, I guess, and probably Manowar is probably another one that was influenced by Saxon. Okay, then we go to the mid-tempo track Nightmare. And what do you think of that one?
Yes, yeah, so Blake, if you're like you and me, I know we both have talked a few different times about how neither one of us are particularly big fans of ballads. And so if anyone out there who is similar to us in that regard, hold your breath here for these first few seconds because this one sounds eerily like a ballad might be coming, at least at the very beginning. Listeners might get a little bit worried if you're not into that sort of thing, but there is still a really cool melody from Biff as the song really gets going, and then that rhythm section begins to pound away. And as it really kicks in, your possible concerns or even fears, if you're in my case, fears that a ballad is coming, are somewhat relieved because it's really not a ballad. It is a little bit of a slower song, but it does add some nice variety to the album, I think. And even though it's hard to sort of rank the solos on this album because the guitar work is just impeccable all the way through, the solo in this particular song might just be the best one on the entire album, at least in my opinion. The guitar work is incredible. And it just shows how great this album is because this would not be one of my favorite songs on the album, but I can still thoroughly enjoy it at any time, especially what Biff does with his vocals as he comes in, and it sort of creates a little bit of a bombastic atmosphere, but I don't mean that in a denigrating way. I think it's actually a good thing. And so good song, not one of my favorites, but I think it's still well done, and it does add a little bit of variety to the sound. So I would still give it pretty high marks.
Yes, and well, yeah, it's not a ballad. I mean, like you said, yeah, it starts off like a ballad, but it's we do get one of those later, I would say, because I did make a note of that later on side two there, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, it's not the heaviest song, but it's still a good song, yes, and there's a lot of great guitar solos from Saxon, like this, but that was like the norm and seen back then, all these bands like Maiden and Priest and whatever that came after, and like, well, everything that came in 1982, 83, and so on. Then I think that's was, yeah, so this is an 8-song album, so that obviously was the end of side one if we're going back to the old days. And then they go off with This Town Rocks, which I suppose was made just to play live. So what do you think of this song, This Town Rocks?
Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you on that one, Blake. I mean, this one has to take every listener back to when you were in high school, maybe early college, right? When you're certainly legal driving age and you're hopping in the car, and depending on what time period you're from, it could be 8-track, it could be cassette tape, could be CD, depending on where you're what time period we're talking about, but we are back to full-fledged, in-your-face, pure heavy metal with this song. Biff firmly puts the question forward at the very beginning. He says, "Does this town know how to rock?" And you really get the music just kicks in with that really killer guitar riff. We get more some of that fast double bass drumming there from Glockler on this song, and it kicks us right into full swing. The bass stands out once again on this one. I know I've harped on that a couple of times already, but it really assists the drums in holding down the tempo in the background. Much the same way I think of like a Malcolm Young in AC/DC would stand at the back and just hold down that rhythm and be the solid backbone for the music while Angus was running around doing his antics on stage. So same sort of thing here. We get this rhythm section really holding it down. The chorus here, it's pretty simplistic, just kind of saying over and over, "This town rocks," but it's effective. All right, I think we talked about that a little bit on the Twisted Sister episode as well. Sometimes less is more. You don't always need to force things. Sometimes you can just do a simple fist pumping chorus and it can be incredibly effective. But just picture those younger days where you're out cruising around with your friends and don't have a whole lot of cares in the world. And just letting this song blast and talking about how this town rocks. And so, as Biff proudly proclaims that statement, just as a listener and as a huge fan, even though I live in a small town, I just have to admit, full disclosure, I picture that Mr. Byford is talking about my town as he sings these lyrics. This town rocks. And the pace for this one takes on a little bit of a Motorhead feel in some ways, at least to my ears. We get another killer solo here that just blazes forth. It's difficult for me to say whether it's this track or the title track that would be my favorite on the album. That could probably flip-flop depending on the day, but this one is just a great way to kick off the second half of the album. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a great way to start off a side of an album if you're going back to the vinyl days or cassette days. And like I don't like in yeah, there's not much. It's a pretty basic song, and it's not very complex, of course. Like you said about the chorus, how they just keep saying this town knows how to rock. But in the song, he's saying he mentions a few towns, I guess you want to call them towns. But he says, I've walked the streets of London, I've been to Tokyo, I've seen the Colosseum, and I've grasped the Berlin Wall. And he's heard the bands of Scotland, he's seen the Alpine snow, I've crossed the Mississippi, and I've touched the Alamo. But it's just kind of funny. There's like, so that's like, those two are in the States, right? And then I'm not sure where the Alpine snow is, which, where that is. I don't see Canada in there, but that's all right. It's kind of reminiscent of one of their other songs, which I can't remember the name of it, but it's, I don't know, maybe, I don't think it's in the band's Played On song, but I just can't remember what it is now. But where they say about playing metal or hard rock or whatever, I just can't, maybe this song title will come to me once I find it and I'll say what that was. But anyway, yeah, it's a great side, a great way to start side two. Then now, is this song about aliens or about stars? I'm not really sure. But anyway, watching the sky. What do you think of this one?
Yeah, that's a great question, Blake. I was wondering that to myself as well. What exactly are we referencing here if we're watching the sky? Hopefully it's not a group of us looking crazy with our tinfoil hats out in the front yard. But yeah, this one's a little bit shorter as well. A little bit more of a melodic guitar intro to this song. And although the rhythm guitar, it does come in nice and heavy to complement it, so it doesn't stay super soft. And this is another one to me that has more of a straightforward rock and roll sound to it, as much as it is a heavy metal song. For me now, this one, the chorus definitely has a more commercial sound to it, if I'm being honest. It is very melodic. And if I had to pick a track on this album that I would say largely sounds closest to what we might conceptualize as the glam slash hair metal type of sound, I would say this is probably the one. Obviously we talked about that a little bit with Nightmare being a little bit more of a ballad sounding song, at least at the beginning, and having a little bit more melody. And it's a song that you could maybe a little more easily picture being played on pop radio or something like that. It's a song that's not so offensive in terms of the aggression to the average listener. So, but yeah, it's a good song. And having said that about the whole glam reference, it's not to say that this is a glam song. It's just simply that the sound here tends to remind me the most of that type of style, or what we would lump into the more hair metal style, I guess you would say. But the guitar solo, when that kicks in, the music gets really heavy. I mean, it's some of the heaviest music on the album that's playing in the background while the solo is going on. So there's a little bit of a Jekyll and Hyde feel to this track, as far as I'm concerned. But I guess I would say overall, the feel leans a little bit more commercial here. And it was after this album, as you mentioned already, Crusader was the album that came out after this, the very next year in '84. And that album, I think, and especially on into Innocence Is No Excuse, you start to hear Saxon do a little bit more of a commercial sound. And we talked about that in the last episode as well. Lots of record labels were pushing bands to go in that direction as they started to see which bands were the cream of the crop and that were going to rise to the top and be able to sell more albums. And Saxon did Rock the Nations in '86, and Destiny in 88. I mean, those albums really do have quite a bit of a glam feel to them. So not to say that Watching the Sky is a glam song, but it definitely leans a little bit more commercial to my ears. I don't know if you thought the same thing, Blake.
Well, I didn't mind the song. I don't know. Yeah, I guess it is a little bit hinting, or yeah, leaning towards that way, but I still do remember liking that song a lot. And I don't know, I don't know if it's about aliens. It could be about nuclear war or impending disaster, but I'm not really sure exactly. But anyway, but yes, that was another good track. Now, unfortunately, we get to my least favorite track, Midas Touch. Even though it sounds like it would be a good song, the title, Midas Touch. But I guess this is a ballad, I think I would say. So, what do you think of this one?
Yeah, that's a great point. Same for me. I mean, I know we've talked about it before, and I think I've heard you mention it in some other episodes that I've listened to as well. Sometimes we can just look at the track listing and we start to form opinions, or not really opinions, I guess, yet, but impressions, I should say, about what we think the songs are going to sound like just based on the title. And so you do see this title, Midas Touch, and you think about King Midas and that whole story about everything he touched turned to gold. And as far as I'm concerned, 99% of what Saxon has touched has turned to gold. So perhaps a nice precursor to the incredible catalog that we have available to us now, all these years later. But we do have a nice gritty guitar riff in this one. And I'm with you. It definitely takes on more of that softer feel for the most part, but I still did enjoy the riff quite a bit. I would say I like this song better than both Nightmare and Watching the Sky, but it would still fall in those bottom three songs, I guess, if we were ranking the songs on the album as far as our favorites go. But it takes no prisoners, I guess, as far as these things go. Things do calm down a little bit as Biff's vocals come in. It gets a little bit softer, and it makes for a softer sound, at least during the verses. But I do notice that it gets a little bit heavier during the chorus, which is nice. So we have again a pretty good way of deftly balancing melody and heaviness here, although it never gets particularly heavy like we talked about. But for the solo in this one, I think the solo, not only is it very well done, but it's a bit more emotional and whimsical, I would say, as it carries on. But as the solo continues, it just continues to get heavier and heavier, and it shreds more and more. So it's almost like one of those progressive solos, right? It starts a little softer, and you feel like reflecting on life. And then as the solo continues, the music behind it just gets heavier and heavier, and you're thinking, man, this is turning into a face melter here. This is pretty cool. And so and how many metalheads, let's be honest, how many of us wouldn't love feeling like the one who has the Midas touch, right? We could go out there, everything we touch turns to gold. Maybe as we're cruising around this town that rocks, right? To tie it back. Great track.
Now, according to Setlist website that says how many times they've played songs live, they've never played this one live, according to it, which is, I don't know what that says. I don't know if you talk to Bill there, the singer, and they've made 24 albums, but you said, how come you never played Midas Touch? I'm wondering if he would even remember. What album is that on again? I don't know, like, because he's not getting any younger, that's for sure. And
Yeah,
so yeah, they never played it
Biff's in
live,
his
so I'm not sure why they didn't do that. But anyway, and then we
70s.
close out with, like, I don't know, I guess this is almost a 7 minute track with The Eagle Has Landed, and you'd almost think this sounds like an album title. They didn't call another album this, did they? But anyway, The Eagle Has Landed. What do you think of the closing track?
Yeah, so this one, if I thought the opening track could have been considered an epic, even though it's heavy and it's not necessarily structured in a bunch of different ways all the way through. By contrast, this closing song, "The Eagle Has Landed," I think this one fits the epic label perfectly. As you said, it's just under 7 minutes long, so it's a nice long track to close the album, and we get almost like a futuristic sound effect that kicks this one off as it gets started. And We have a very slow, deliberate pace at the beginning of the song as the drums come in, and they're kind of plodding along almost in a more doomy type of way, almost a sludge type of way, if you will. And the guitars kind of put the listener in a bit of a trance while it continues on. And the thing that popped into my head as I was listening to it, especially in the first couple of minutes of the song, is that this sound is almost reminiscent of a psychedelic rock type of sound to it, which is interesting. It's an interesting change of pace for Saxon. And it's something that sounds like, hey, they could play that on the radio and casual listeners wouldn't necessarily mind. But after the first couple of minutes, the drums pick up the pace a little bit, and then you get that heavy mid-paced riff that's just a killer riff that comes in. So we get really a nice build-up in those first couple of minutes to what would ultimately be the crux or the meat of the song. And it does get a little bit slower again as Biff starts to sing, but you get the feeling as the listener that the song is continuing to build to something great. And this song does just that. And I know these are two totally different songs, but as I was listening, I almost liken it in terms of the song structure to a song like One by Metallica, right? Where the first half of the song is, it's definitely softer, but it still has this quality about it that you're eager as the listener to continue to see where the song is going to take you. And of course, for Metallica's One, the back half of that song is absolutely ferocious. So different type of style here, but I think the same thing is true in terms of the structure. It continues to build, it engages your attention as the listener, and you just feel like it's getting ready to explode into something special. And it does just that, in my opinion, as the song goes on. We get another great solo with that heavy rhythm section backing it up. The song, like we said, truly does have an epic feel to it. And in my opinion, it's got a little bit of everything. It's got heaviness, it's got some of the soft, introspective sound to it. It's got the great guitar work. It really does have a little bit of everything. In my opinion, just a fantastic way to close the album.
Yes, and I would also agree that there's some even some doominess in that one too. Like you said, I know that's not really a thing we talk about with Saxon necessarily, but of course, and the song is about, I don't know, space travel, military thing again, I'm not really sure, but anyway, yeah, it's a great closing track, but it would have been a great album title.
Absolutely.
They might have, maybe they had a live album called that. I don't know, because it seems like that would be a good album title. And that song they played the second most from this album whenever they played live. This was from this album, I mean. But like I think Power and the Glory was like 9 out of 10 songs that they've played. Like, so I don't know what spot this is in there, but this is the second most that they played from this album anyway. So that's the album. I was just gonna before we. No, I guess we can rate it first. What would you rate this album out of 10?
Yeah, so this album for me, it is in my top five Saxon albums. So it's really good. I am going to go with a 9 for this one, and only because there are a couple of moments on the album that just aren't necessarily my favorite Saxon moments, and that would be the track "Nightmare," and the other track would be "Watching the Sky." Certainly not dumping on those songs. They're very good songs, and even some of my least favorite Saxon songs are still better than a large majority of the material that's out there because this band truly is great. So I'd have to dock it just a little bit for those songs, not to say that they're bad. Yeah, I'm gonna have to go with a 9 on this one because of that.
Okay, I think I would probably like. I remember when it came out, when it was out in '83, I listened to it a lot. And like I said before, I listened to Crusader album a lot and Strong Arm of the Law a lot. So back then, I probably would have thought this is a 10 or something because I listened to it so much. But since it's been so long, so I guess from today, I'm going to give it like an 8.5, I guess, because I still think Strong Arm of the Law is one I like the best, with Heavy Metal Thunder on it, Dallas 1 PM, which is kind of different. They're talking about the assassination of the president when they're from England. But anyway, now, have you ever seen them live?
I have unfortunately never gotten a chance to see Saxon live. And you mentioned it earlier, Blake. You know, in this day and age with the internet, bands are not making money off of physical album sales much anymore. I mean, there are some people, if you go to YouTube, there are vinyl collectors that have channels. And so vinyl records seem to be coming back, but it's more of a collectible type of thing and a hobby for some folks. But nowadays, the way bands make the majority of their money, of course, is by live shows. Ticket sales and selling merchandise at the shows. But if you're coming overseas, from what I hear, it can get quite expensive by the time everybody is done taking their cut, whether it's the promoter or the venue or, you know, those who are printing the designs for t-shirts. And so by the time you cut into all that, and bands have to get their passports and all these different things to go overseas, it is quite a production to try and tour. And when that is your main source of income, sometimes bands have to make difficult decisions about where they can and can't play. And I have not looked at Saxon's touring schedule, so I'm not suggesting necessarily that they've just said, oh, it's too expensive to go play in America. I'm sure they have played here a number of times, but I don't know how many more times we'll see Saxon over this way, especially given, you know, Biff, I think, is in his early 70s now. So I'm not sure how many more opportunities I'll have, but if they do come out this way anytime in the next couple of years, hopefully before they decide to hang it up, I'll be able to get there because at this point, it is absolutely a bucket list thing for me.
No, I actually seen them once, but that's when I was in Spain because they played at a, I can't remember the name of the festival, but they have a festival in Spain, heavy metal, hard rock or whatever. And so I saw Saxon there, but I can't really remember. This was like 7 years ago, I think now, but I can't really remember much about it because there's so many bands there. So of course it's hard to stand out, whatever, but I do remember seeing them there because that's the only time I've ever seen them. I don't know if they've ever, like, because it is hard, like you just said, and I said before, for these, unless you're Metallica or Black Sabbath or whatever, you can't really afford to come over and play if you're only going to be playing to 1,000, 2,000 people or whatever. And even though Saxon has been around so long, they never made it as big as those, like, they never made it as big as Maiden and Priest, even though they're still going, which is great, but they just were always had a lot of fans, just not enough fans, I guess, that would really blow them over the top or whatever. So anyway, yeah, so I've seen them once live, so. But again, I can't really comment much about it because it was like a blur. Okay. So, and yeah, I don't know if they're going to tour the United States again. I know even like Helloween, another group, power metal group from Europe, they did come to North America last year or 2 years ago, I think it was. But I know they don't come very often. And I've never seen them, even though they were one of my favorite bands too. But it's just, yeah, it just costs too much money these days now. Especially with tariffs now. Okay, we're gonna do our top 10 albums of 1983. Now, I've probably did this before on some other podcast. I can't, because let's see, from, well, I'll maybe say it after I do my top 10. I'll do my top 10 first, I guess. So I've probably did this before, but these could be in a different order than I did them that time because I'm just looking at the albums going, okay, I'll put this one, whatever. So who knows if somebody wants to remind me, because we've done whole, we've done, well, wait, I'll wait till I do. Okay, I have some honorable mentions because there's so many in 1983. I mean, I'm looking through the list going, wow, there's so many. How am I going to do this? So one of them would be the one we just did. It's not on my top 10 list, but this album, Saxon, and we had, let's see, Canadian thrash band Exciter had their first album, Heavy Metal Maniac, that year. Female metal band Rock Goddess released two albums that year that I really liked, Hell Hath No Fury and the self-titled debut, as they had two albums out in the same year. And let's see, Ozzy had Bark at the Moon back then, which I liked then. And Twisted Sister, Can't Stop Rock and Roll, was also 1983. And we probably talked about that in the last podcast. So now, the 10 that I do have here. Number 10, I got Merciful Fate and their album Melissa, which I guess is their debut album. Yes. And my number 9, I have Crocus with Headhunter. And I don't know, people probably surprised. Why do I have Crocus above Ozzy or above, whatever. But I just love that album, that Crocus album. It's definitely the only Crocus album that I listen to regularly. Once in a while, I mean. Number eight, I got another Canadian band, and this is, I guess people might call them hair metal, but Helix with their album No Rest for the Wicked. I grew up on listening to Helix, and I've seen them play a few times, so they made it on here as number eight. My number seven is another Canadian band, and that's Anvil with Forged in Fire, their third album, as I love my old Anvil. Number six, I got Slayer's first album, Show No Mercy. Number five, I have Black Sabbath with Born Again, which is actually my favorite Black Sabbath album, which I'm sure people will hate to know. But I love Ian Gillan, and even though it's not really, it's more or less a Deep Purple album than a Black Sabbath album, but whatever. It's got Tony Iommi on it and everything. I think just because of Ian Gillan, it sounds like it's Deep Purple, not Black Sabbath. Because their sound was a lot different on that one. My number four is Raven with All for One. I love that album. I want to do a podcast about that album sometime. I have to find somebody else that likes it as much as I do. My number three is Iron Maiden's Peace of Mind. My number two is the first, well, I'm calling it the first thrash metal ever album ever, and that is Metallica's Kill 'Em All. And my number one is Dio with Holy Diver. And there we go. And there was other bands too, I probably could have mentioned too, but that's enough. Okay, let's hear your, oh wait, I was going to mention podcasts. I'm sure we've done Holy Diver, we've done Peace of Mind, we've done Kill 'Em All. And I think we've done Melissa also, Merciful Fate. So yeah, so we've already did four or five of these. So one of those, I'm sure I already did a top 10 of 1983. I just don't remember which one. So anyway, okay, let's hear your top 10 of 1983.
Awesome. That was a great list, Blake. And just as a quick side note for Sabbath, if I'm really going to piss some people off here, but my favorite Black Sabbath album is actually 13, the one that they did much more recently where Ozzy was back in the fold,
Oh,
and
okay.
just a great album. But Sabbath has great stuff from every era. So Dio era is my favorite of all. But yeah, there's just something special about 13 with everybody from the original lineup except for Bill Ward on drums. But that's okay. We got everybody else back. So, yeah, a couple of quick honorable mentions for me. Twisted Sister, You Can't Stop Rock and Roll would be on there. Headhunter by Crocus, I had that one as well. Crocus is a big favorite of mine. But I lean more toward the modern stuff. Hoodoo from 2010, Dirty Dynamite from 2013, even going to Hellraiser from 2006. I mean, they just have some really great stuff. And frontman Mark Starace released a solo album called Starace, or the album was called Crossfire under the Starace name that he just released last year, I believe it was. And that's a tremendous album. So if you're a Crocus fan, would definitely recommend picking that one up.
I actually also saw them in Spain too at the same festival.
Oh, very cool. Awesome. Yeah. Oh, Crocus is fantastic. Some people call them an AC/DC wannabe. I don't agree with that at all. I love Crocus. And
Well,
I
the only
think,
The song Long Stick Goes Boom is the only one that I really think sounds like AC/DC. And I
yeah,
always
there you go.
embarrassed. It comes on my phone and go, oh, here's AC/DC. Oh, wait, this isn't AC/DC. Oh.
Yeah.
Anyway,
And
go ahead.
AC/DC is my favorite rock and roll band of all time, so there's no problems with sounding like them. I think Starace has a little bit of Bon Scott in his voice, which is really cool. But yeah, so as I dive into my top 10, so my number 10, shout out to Canada, I've got Heavy Metal Maniac from Exciter. Just an incredible album, and the fact that they could have a drummer who doubles as vocalist is unbelievable to me, especially when you consider that they're playing speed metal. I mean, I don't know how, is it Dan Beeler? Is that how you pronounce that last name?
Yes, I think that's correct.
Yeah, he's just incredible. So just a fantastic album there, and Long Live the Loud, and they've got some really great albums in that discography. It just really an incredible band. So and never made it as big as they should have, in my opinion. And speaking of Canada, I guess I should have mentioned Anvil as one of my honorable mentions as well. Forged in Fire from that year. Coming in at number 9 for me, I have Shout at the Devil from Motley Crue. Please, nobody, pelt me with tomatoes for that pick. But
Yeah, that's another one.
I love Motley Crue's first couple of albums. I will say Too Fast for Love, Shout at the Devil. And I like some stuff from Girls, Girls, Girls. And, there's some good stuff here and there, even on the self-titled album from, I think it was 94, where John Corabi came on board. Some of those songs were really heavy. And so they've got some good stuff here and there, but nothing beats the first couple of albums for me. So Shout at the Devil had to be on my list. Coming in at number eight, I have an album called Loose and Lethal by a band called Savage. Not sure if how many listeners are going to be familiar with that one, but I don't know that Savage had a whole lot of albums after that, but it does seem to be a little bit of a cult following for that album. A lot of people really, really love it, and I have to say it is one of my favorite albums from top to bottom of all time. So Loose and Lethal by Savage, for any listeners that have never heard that album, do yourself a favor and check that one out if you like sort of that traditional heavy metal sound. Coming in at number seven for me, I've got Holy Diver from Dio. And you mentioned that one already, Blake. Ronnie James Dio had been in Rainbow, and then he recorded the first two of the three Black Sabbath albums that he was on with Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules, and then went on to do the solo thing. And so here's his first solo album. And this one and Last in Line are sort of neck and neck. Most people consider them both to be equally legendary. So Holy Diver had to be on this list for me, if for no other reason than the title track and Rainbow in the Dark. I mean, those two songs are worth the price of admission alone for that album, in my opinion. Coming in at number six for me, I've got Peace of Mind by Iron Maiden. And while Number of the Beast is my favorite Maiden album, Peace of Mind came out the very next year. It was only the second album with Bruce Dickinson on board. And it's a very close second for me on my list of favorite Maiden albums. Just an incredible album from start to finish, balancing the melody with the shredding guitars. I mean, you can't go wrong really with the first five, and I would even say the first seven really Iron Maiden albums for me. So that one had to be on the list. Number five, coming into my top five now, is going to be Balls to the Wall from Accept. And that album just, I don't know if you can really find a more, a riff that better epitomizes heavy metal than the riff to the title track on that album. Just a really, really great, strong song. And of course, this was the album that followed right on the heels of Restless and Wild, which is a very widely revered Accept album and just widely revered heavy metal album in general. And so Balls to the Wall really followed up on that. And it is just heavy. You've got Udo Dirkschneider wailing away on the microphone. Wolf Hoffmann, of course, who is, I believe, as of this day and age, the only remaining original member of Accept. And as much heresy as this might seem, I'm actually more of a fan of the modern Accept era with Mark Tornillo on vocals. That's mostly all I listen to when it comes to Accept. But when it comes to the Udo era, Restless and Wild and that album Balls to the Wall are the two that I come back to most often. I do like Russian Roulette and Objection Overruled and some of those, but Balls to the Wall had to make my list. Number four is going to be this album that we talked about here on this episode today, Power and the Glory from Saxon. Album number five for them. And as we talked about, kind of introduced more of that power metal feel to it. And it would be after that album with Crusader and the next few after that, like we talked about, that they would venture in a little bit more of a commercial direction. But they still maintain their heaviness for the most part all the way through. So had to have Power and the Glory on the list because it is tremendous. If the worst part about an album is the album cover artwork, then I think we're doing okay. great album there. Coming in at number three for me, I've got Another Perfect Day from Motorhead. And that album, it's very interesting. I wanted to take a moment to comment on it. It's very interesting how that album was received back when it came out, and then to see how the general outlook and perception of that album has shifted in more modern times. So when that album came out back in 83, it got a little bit of flack from fans. It was a little bit more melodic than the previous few albums. Of course, they had Brian Robertson from Thin Lizzy come into the band. And so a lot of people really loved and revered and still do to this day that original three-headed monster for Motorhead's lineup, which was Lemmy, Filthy Phil Taylor, and Fast Eddie Clarke. And so that's kind of the Motorhead lineup that everybody loves the most, at least from the classic days. And so with this album, Another Perfect Day, that Motorhead put out in 83, they did not have that three-headed monster of a lineup anymore. And so when you hear Brian Robertson bring that Thin Lizzy influence into the sound, there were some people who didn't love it. Like I said, it was a little bit more melody. It didn't quite have the same type of speed and ferocity in a lot of the songs that fans had gotten used to in those previous few albums, like, you know, Overkill and Bomber and Ace of Spades and Iron Fist. You know, the sounds of Another Perfect Day were a little bit different. And so it wasn't particularly well received, at least for the most part back then. But then if you shift gears a little bit into the modern day with the passage of time and subsequent generations listening to the album, it is a lot better received now. There are a lot of people that have great things to say about it. A lot of people think it's one of the best albums that Motorhead ever did in a catalog of, you know, we talk about Saxon with 24 albums, Motorhead had 22. So Motorhead has quite an extensive catalog. And I think Another Perfect Day is a really, really solid Motorhead album. So that had to be on my list. Coming in at number two for me, I'm going with Flick of the Switch from AC/DC. And I know it's rock and roll and not heavy metal, but AC/DC is my favorite rock band, as I've mentioned a moment ago. And Flick of the Switch was a little bit different. It was the third album with Brian Johnson on vocals by that point, and followed right on the heels of Back in Black and For Those About to Rock, We Salute You. And those two albums were very, very polished. You had Mutt Lange's production, and it was very smooth and almost, some people felt, possibly a little bit overproduced. And so for Flick of the Switch, AC/DC decided to produce the album themselves. And so the album had a little bit more of a raw feel to it, not quite as much polish. It's a very short album. I believe it's 11 tracks, but it clocks in at maybe 35 minutes, maybe a little bit less. But lots of great songs on that one. You know, Rising Power, House is on Fire, Landslide, Badlands, just great songs all over the place. So other than the fact that the album cover looks like a first grader picked up a pencil and drew a sketch in art class, still a really, really great album in my opinion. So that's why it's so high up, just because AC/DC is one of my absolute favorites. And then coming in at number one, I'm sure a lot of people could have guessed it, but it is Kill 'Em All by Metallica. And it was really the birth of thrash. And I know Slayer had Show No Mercy this same year. I think it came out a little bit later that year. And some people have said that Exodus, which was actually Kirk Hammett's original band, really had the material for their debut, Bonded by Blood, ready to go in 83. And apparently it was an album that many people feel should have been released in 83. And if it had been, now I'm not sure what the full story is, if it was a record label issue or whatever the case may be, but if it had been released that year, depending on the time of year, if it was slightly released before Kill 'Em All or maybe right around the same time, that Exodus would at least receive equal credit to Metallica for the launch of thrash. And so, you know, we'll never know, because of course, Bonded by Blood didn't come out until 85, but Kill 'Em All from Metallica has to be on here. It really changed the entire game when it comes to thrash. Thrash is that genre that blended the ferocity of heavy metal with the speed of punk. And it combined the two and put it into a blender and gave us a really, really ferocious sound. And right from the first notes, as the guitar fades in on that song, Hit the Lights, and all the way through to the absolute bruising album closer, Metal Militia, Kill 'Em All is a masterpiece from start to finish. And just to think these guys were in their late teens, maybe early 20s at the time the album came out. But it is a game changer of an album, and so that had to take my top spot. So that's my top 10 from 1983. But again, like you said, I know Merciful Fate had Melissa that year. There were several that we could mention, but just didn't quite have enough room for them all.
Yes, and Balls to the Wall could have been on my list too. And I do like Motorhead, but I probably just like other albums more than that one that year. And yeah, I'm a more of a Bon Scott AC/DC, but I didn't mind back then Flick of the Switch and those albums. But Yeah, so okay. So the eagle has landed, so we have to end their podcast. So thanks, James, for joining me again on the episode.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks, Blake. I appreciate you having me. This was an absolute blast.
And yes, that's a wrap for this episode. Thanks everybody for tuning in, and please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to our podcast, or if it's on YouTube, you listen to it there. Please follow us there too. And if you have any album suggestions, feel free to let me know. Podcast@themetalpit.org. If you want to email me suggestion, or maybe you want to be a guest on a podcast like James did 3 episodes ago. And yeah, don't forget to check out our website, themetalpit.org. So until next time, keep it heavy.